Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. It's Friday. We're going to go deep, deep, deep into shallow thought. No. I want you to kind of get your rock geek on. Get your geologist geek on, right? Which I wear an awful lot. It's not far off. I kind of like the sciences and the fun stuff, like earthquakes. Well, not so fun, right? If you're in one and it's destroying your home, right? But a number have been triggered now off in the Pacific Ocean. Earthquakes, volcanic activity. Some say that there's one out there, coast California, that's big and angry at the moment. Earthquakes in Alaska, even Nevada. And that's not unusual because they happen an awful lot. But there was a new thermal opening in Yellowstone National Park. Oh, what's going on there? Let's find out, okay? Dr. Jamie Farrell, a friend of ours from the University of Utah and the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory, going to join us once again to update us on this unique and active landscape we live in here in Montana on Voices of Montana today. What is going on? We've got these volcanic activity. You're looking at, maybe you've seen the videos, a major eruption in Iceland. And this was sort of, well, not that long ago. They got lava flowing, gas emissions. They've affected some nearby towns there as well. The videos, you just, I don't know, I can't drag my eyes off of them at times too. This is off the Oregon coast, the axial seamount. The seafloor is ballooning there. And they think that's significant magma build up and over 1,000 daily quakes. And that's not unusual. I was looking back at some of the stuff we did with Jamie when we talked about the Hebgen Lake 60th. I hate to call it an anniversary, but the 60th anniversary of you know, that seismic happening where we had an earthquake in the Ennis area, and it created a landslide, and Hebgen Lake was created off of that, 60-plus years ago now. Anyway, I think last year, maybe it was a couple of years ago, the June seems to be a hot month for Yellowstone. There was like 1,000 seismic eruptions, so to speak, and they're not real huge. A lot of them you're not going to notice, and that's one of the things that they've been working on is to, you know, try to make sense of what these smaller plate tectonic and seismic activities mean. Of course, when you see the seafloor ballooning off the coast of Oregon and you see these 1,000 daily quakes, you're starting to wonder, could a major eruption happen before the end of 2025? Some experts do stress that could happen, but it poses no tsunami risk, they say. Maybe it's because it's deep down, so deep under the ocean here. The earthquake in Alaska on the Aleutian Islands earlier this week, this happened, what day is it? Just 2 days ago. It was a 7.3 magnitude earthquake, and it struck off the southern coast there. It did prompt a tsunami warning along a 700-mile stretch, and I don't know if you're ever, you know, just doom-scrolling on your phone. If you've doom-scrolled to these points before, you'll see, you know, videos come up of these kinds of disasters and tsunamis, and they're real, you know, especially in the Indian Ocean and you know, more so in areas that have that kind of exposure. But the warning there was downgraded. It was a 700-mile stretch for a tsunami warning, but that warning was downgraded and later canceled, and because only 3 inches of wave activity were recorded there in Sandpoint. And they had 40 aftershocks within the first 3 hours. No injuries, no major damage there. And again, that's off the, that's in Alaska, the Aleutian Islands there. 6.2 earthquake struck about 130 miles south of Punta Barica. That's Panama. Authorities confirmed there was no tsunami there, no major damage. There was one that, of course, people are talking about still, March 28th. The Myanmar region, devastating well, they've got it near an 8.0 Richter scale. 7.7 to 7.9, they say, on the Richter scale. And those are strong. That's the strongest earthquake in Myanmar since 1912. And 11,000 lost their lives there. Of course, when you look at some of those third world countries, and you know, they don't have the same kinds of protections, the opportunities to, mitigate potential damage there. I got that wrong. 11,000 injured. It was 5,400 that lost their lives there. Heavy structural damage too. So Japan since June of 2025, since June 25th of this year, they had almost 1,200 tremors that have rattled the island chain there. They had their peak on July 4th with a notable quake around magnitude six, and that was the most intense quake swarm there since 1995. Around 31 local residents evacuated. Many left, homeless in those areas. So as we kind of take a look at these global hotspots there and wondering about public safety, what do we do for public safety when it comes to earthquake protection? I know our technology and our engineering have come a long ways, but and I've never been in an earthquake outside of the one that happened in Helena, maybe, what was it? Is it 10 years ago now? Just a minor one, but I was in Missoula and I felt it. And it was a strange kind of feeling. And I'm curious Jamie's going to come on here. Dr. Jamie Farrell will be with us again here. He is a seismologist, University of Utah, and works at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory there. Measures all of this. Another thing that we're talking about here too is there's a new hole that's been blown open in Yellowstone. It's not real big, but it's significant because, well, there's a lot of things to kind of unpack when we look at Yellowstone. In kind of preparing for this show, discovered that there's a hidden magma cap that was discovered in Yellowstone National Park. That was earlier this year, and geologists have said that that is likely playing a critical role in preventing a massive eruption of one of the world's largest active volcanic systems in the world. In fact, at Huddle today, we're talking about, is Yellowstone a volcano? Because I don't want it going off. Well, the whole thing is a volcano. The whole park sits in a volcanic caldera. So it is one of the largest active volcanic systems in the world. And we've talked about from time to time, and there are movies. I don't know if you like those disaster movies or not. They're kind of fun to do. What happens if it gets angry, if that volcano gets angry, so to speak, or time is up, well, then it's flat out time is up. So that's what we're going to look at today, just to have some fun for a Friday. Public safety measures, but also let's get caught up to date. How do they know that there was a hidden magma cap discovered, and how did they discover that? And then this goes back a couple of years. Yellowstone has a lot more magma in it than previously thought. And what is the significance of some of these new openings? This was a hydrothermal explosion that left an opening in a pool, a hot pool. They're always constantly trying to monitor, but the piping is always changing there underneath that caldera. As we look at Montana and it's shaking a little bit here and there, and then we look around the world and it's crumbling, who do we call when the world's crumbling? Well, it's Dr. Jamie Farrell from the University of Utah and the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. Good morning, Dr. Farrell. How you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Appreciate that. Always enjoy the intrigue of our, sciences and Earth and what's going on. Let's just start with this new hole in Yellowstone, right? And I'm not sure how big of a deal it is because these hydrothermal explosions happen quite frequently. I guess there's been some scientific advancement in understanding those. But what happens in Yellowstone when you, I suppose the piping changes on a daily basis almost, huh?
I mean, that's one of the great things about studying Yellowstone is it's so dynamic and things are happening all the time. I mean, things change, like you said, daily. These small hydrothermal explosions are part of those that dynamic system. And, you know, recently we found a few of these small ones, and we started to put in instrumentation to try to record these. Of course, we had the bigger one last year at Biscuit Basin, but, you know, these are just small ones that are occurring. Luckily, these are occurring, you know, away from the boardwalks, but there is a possibility these things could occur next to a boardwalk during the time where people are there. So that's what we worry about.
Well, and you had that explosion. I think it was Geyser Basin. Maybe it was Norris. That was recorded. You know, that probably provided you a lot of you know, visual information, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we had the big one last year on July 23rd in Biscuit Basin, in Biscuit. The Upper Geyser Basin. Unfortunately, that one, we did not have instrumentation close by. So we didn't really record a lot for that one, but we have recorded some smaller ones in Norris Geyser Basin. And actually, we are actually putting in a new permanent station in Biscuit Basin to record for, you know, future activity at Black Diamond Pool at Biscuit Basin. So we're doing that right now.
Have you seen some activity in interim since then, last year's?
Yeah, that pool continues to erupt and have small explosions. We have temporary instrumentation in there recording that. So hopefully that'll provide us some, you know, some valuable data to you know, see what these things look like as far as on a seismometer and the temperature record. And then, you know, once we have this permanent network in, we can look for signals like that and see if we can see any kind of precursory activity to these types of explosions.
Dr. Jamie Farrell with us again, University of Utah, a research professor, Department of Geology and Geophysics, and again at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory. That's been around since 2001 and includes like 9 federal and state agencies. Give us a little overview of, you know, what's a day in life like there at the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory?
Well, the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory is a little bit different than the other volcano observatories that the USGS operates. We are more of like a virtual observatory. We don't really have our own building. But like you said, we're a consortium of 9 different organizations. The University of Utah, where I'm at, one of them. Our part of the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory is we operate the seismic network in and around Yellowstone. So our job as part of that organization is to monitor the region for earthquakes, locate earthquakes, send out information regarding earthquakes that have happened, and then respond to, you know, larger events as they occur. And then any other type of event like the hydrothermal explosion that occurred last year. So we respond to that by putting on instrumentation, helping with analysis. And then, you know, my particular role in the Yellowstone Volcano Observatory is I'm the chief seismologist. So, you know, if something would happen, I would be the one in charge of putting out, you know, providing the you know, people up higher with information about earthquakes and seismicity and interpreting data that streams that are coming in.
Well, and that's a hard part of the job, I think, because what we're trying to get to, I understand, is the ability to predict for public safety as accurately as we can. And I know that there's always, it seems like there's new technology or new ideas with old technology being employed there. Give us an idea of how well our technology currently does assist you in that.
Well, like you said, we're always trying new things. We're always trying to push the envelope, testing out new, whether it's computing algorithms or new instrumentation to try to better our network. But currently, we're in the process right now of doing kind of a major upgrade on the Yellowstone network. This is a long-term project where we're upgrading a lot of the older technology to newer digital technology. We're doing like 2 stations a year, 2 or 3 stations a year until we've upgraded the entire network. So, you know, we're doing that. We're also kind of upgrading our telemetry network. So this is the network that helps get all the data out of the park up into our system, to add, you know, robust backup systems just in case something goes down so we can reroute data another way. So we can always have current data. So, you know, those types of things. Making sure the network is running all the time and can withstand outages at certain areas.
You guys have daily volcanic activity or seismic activity. I presume. And, you know, maybe give me those numbers. When do they indicate, when does your spidey sense start tingling? You know, when you see those numbers go up a little bit.
Well, Yellowstone averages about 1,500 to 2,500 earthquakes per year. That's a kind of a large range, but it fluctuates, you know, over time. So it is the most active seismic area in the Intermountain West of the United States. And most of those earthquakes are very small, magnitude 2 and smaller, and not felt by anybody except for our instrumentation. But the thing about Yellowstone is about half of the earthquakes that occur there occur as part of what we call a seismic swarm. So these are clusters of earthquakes that happen kind of clustered in time and space. So a lot of earthquakes happening at once in one area. And those swarms can range from, you know, only having, say, you know, a dozen earthquakes in them to having thousands of earthquakes in them, only lasting for an hour or lasting for months. And as you can imagine, when we get one of these larger swarms, that kind of piques the interest of the public. And the thing is that just because we have this big cluster of earthquakes doesn't mean that the volcano is about to erupt. In fact, it's just the way the volcano behaves. We have these clusters of earthquakes that happen, and you know, a lot of people like to jump to that conclusion that something's happening and the volcano is about to erupt. But that's not the case. But we do pay attention when we have these swarms of earthquakes, particularly, you know, the pattern of these earthquakes, how they're acting, whether the magnitudes are slowly getting larger or whether they're migrating with time, getting shallower or getting deeper or moving. So we look at those types of things when they're happening, and we make interpretations based on those types of things.
Do you remember, we chatted a while back, and again, thanks for coming back on the program. Appreciate that. I think as I look back at it, I don't have it in front of me here, but I recall that there was a swarm that kind of lasted through the month of June that wound up, you know, with like 1,000 individual recordable events. You recall that? Was that unusual? And after that, what was the activity like, you know, post that event?
Well, that's the thing about these swarms is, you know, we've had, like I said, our largest swarm ever was recorded in October of 1985. That had about 3,100 events in it.
Wow.
The second largest swarm we had was in 2017, and that had almost 3,000 events in it. And interesting, these swarms that occur, you know, they ramp up. We get a lot of seismicity, a lot of events that are felt, you know, depending on where they're at in the park, if people can feel them, what time of year they are. But this one lasted for many months, and then eventually it just turns off and stops. Mm. Sometimes that's interesting to look at, you know, not only how they start, but also how they end and what triggers the end of these things. So that's one thing that we've thought about, you know, really looking into how these things start and stop and what that tells us about the process of what's causing these things to occur.
Yeah, that would be my next question. You know, what tells you that this is just a release of pressure, so to speak, a good thing, or if it's a ramping up of more potentially higher activity?
Yeah, I mean, most of the time these swarms are probably due to pressurized fluids moving around in the subsurface. Mm. Now, when we say fluids, that could be water, it could be water vapor, it could be gas like CO2. And these are all gases that are coming off of the magma reservoir. And most of the time, it's probably those fluids. Now, it could be magma, depending on how, and we look at how fast these things are moving, and that kind of gives us a clue of what type of fluid. But we can't always really tell. And, you know, depending on if they're getting shallower or not, we'll take that into account. But most of the times, these are just, you know, the way that things happen in an active volcanic region. You have a lot of fluids in the crust, and they move around, and they get pressurized, and they cause cracks to form as the pressurized fluid moves through the crust, and that's what causes these little earthquakes.
Give us an idea, because, you know, I think we understand. We've heard of tectonic plates, and we've heard of, you know, whether they go under or over or different types. I don't remember the names for them. There are good scientific names for them. is give us an idea of what kind of plates we're talking about here in Montana. Are they rather large connected plates, or do we end up with smaller kinds of tectonic plates, I guess, for lack of a better word or understanding on my part?
Yeah, well, I mean, like you said, the Earth is made up of tectonic plates, and the vast majority of the earthquakes that occur on Earth occur at those plate boundaries, right, where two plates come together. And that's what, like, the San Andreas Fault in California is. That's a plate boundary. But Yellowstone is not on a plate boundary. Yellowstone is right in the middle of the North American plate. So there's not a plate boundary there. What Yellowstone is what we call a hot spot. And it's an area of prolonged heat and energy coming up from deep within the Earth up to the surface of the Earth. And that's what causes the volcanics to happen on the Earth, because the Earth is constantly pumping out heat and energy up to the surface, and that causes melt and causes volcanic activity. Now, it's also overprinted on, like you said, a tectonic process, and this is the area of the West called the Basin and Range. And this is an area of the Intermountain West where the plate is actively being stretched from east to west and thinned. And when that happens, the crust eventually breaks and causes these big faults, like the Wasatch Fault that we have here in Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. So we have the interaction of this volcanic system in Yellowstone with the overriding Basin and Range tectonic system. How those two interact is not fully understood, but they definitely do have some sort of interaction where you have seismicity and more enhanced seismicity due to the volcanic system.
Did you feel that Alaskan earthquake earlier this week?
No.
No. Too far away, yeah. But it was
7.3. Yep. But our instruments recorded it, for sure.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Volcanic waves passed through Yellowstone.
You know, I probably say this now, but we'll regret saying it later if it ever happened. I'd like to be in an earthquake. I'd like to find out what that feels like. Like I say, I may regret saying that out loud even. But, you know, what that feels like, the ground shaking underneath you, and no matter where you go or turn, it doesn't settle down. And what's going to happen? How long is this going to last? It would be interesting to me as a human to experience that. But again, not sure that I really, really, really want to. Welcome back here from Montana for Montana, Voices of Montana. We got our geek streak going on here as we're talking with and maybe it's not fair to say that, right? But it is a specialized science, but there's a lot of interest in geography, geology, and seismology. University of Utah research professor, Department of Geology and Geophysics, Dr. Jamie Farrell, our guest here today, as we look at a couple of things, you know, increased seismic activity, it seems like, around the world. And Jamie, by the way, have you ever been in an earthquake?
I have. I've been in a couple. Yep.
How long did they last? What was your experience like? What would a first timer like me come away with after that experience?
Well, you know, how long they last depends on how big they are and how close you are to them. But it is a little unnerving when the ground beneath your feet, which you assume to be solid, is not solid anymore, starts shaking. And, you know, my most recent earthquake I've been in was in 2020. We had a magnitude 5.7 here in Salt Lake City. It woke me up out of bed and hurried up and jumped out of bed and got next to the bed, because that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to drop, cover, and hold on while the shaking lasts. But if you were close to that one, the shaking probably lasted for 20 to 30 seconds, probably, on that one. And that's relatively small, 5.7. You know, some of these really big ones, the shaking lasts for, you know, a minute or longer.
Wow. And I've heard people say it feels like it's 5 minutes at a time.
Yeah, for sure. Feels much longer than what it really is. Yeah.
I've got some questions to ask here. We'll go to Skip, though. Skip, Citizen Skip, calls in frequently and with really good questions here. I want to talk about the hidden magma cap that was recently discovered. We'll get to that. But Skip, listening in Hamilton, it's great to have you along there on that station, KLYQ. Hello to our Bitterroot friends, 1290 AM. Skip, good morning. You're on the air, sir.
Thank you, Tom. And I do hope you both have a wonderful weekend. Over here in the Bitterroot Valley, it's hot and calm and sunny and the Front Range looks amazing. I have felt two different earthquakes personally, and it's in like 30 to 45 seconds each one of them, and I said a whole lot of Hail Marys real fast when I was standing right there, and it was like, this is amazing. And so I wanted to ask you, sir, I knew a colleague, I believe, of yours. His name was Dr. Joseph Painter, and he was at the University of Utah, and he worked extensively in Yellowstone. And he wrote a book called Drilling Down. I remember that. And I had many conversations with him about the danger points here in this country when it came to volcanic activity and earthquakes. And he said that Yellowstone was the most amazing, certainly for research and for, okay, when's it going to happen kind of thinking, and depending on where you lived as to how dangerous it would be if there was a major event, and having to do also with I'll say prevailing winds and as to how bad things could get as going to say the southeast if there was a major eruption explosion type of thing. Isn't it a matter of degree as to how bad an event could be as to how much of an explosion and a path of destruction there would be? Is there anything predictable about it? I guess that would be my question.
Yeah, a lot of and people.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me vent.
Thank you, Skip. Yeah, I appreciate that. A lot of people have that question, Jamie. I mean, that's what we wonder. Oh, it's the world's largest volcano. Oh, when's it going to go off?
Yeah, we get that question a lot. And, you know, the one thing, you know, the simple answer is we don't know. But there is more to it than that.
Right.
The good thing about volcanoes as opposed to earthquakes is that when a volcano is going to erupt, for the most part, there is a lot of precursory activity leading up to that eruption. Earthquakes being some of them, ground deformation, increased gas output on the surface. And we monitor for all those things. So the good thing about volcanoes is that when they're, building up to an eruption, we can see these precursory signals. And most likely, we would know that there was going to be a volcanic eruption at Yellowstone if it was going to occur. Now, you know, how long it would last,
right,
how big it was going to be, that's a different story. The problem with these really large volcanoes is that, you know, no one's ever seen these things happen in our lifetimes since humans have been here. So we don't really 100% know how they occur, but we can take a lot of things we've learned from smaller volcanic eruptions and kind of ramp them up. So we're pretty confident that we would have some sort of heads up time that there was going to be a volcanic eruption at Yellowstone. But the thing that we have to tell people is that, you know, there's many different types of hazards related to an active volcano, particularly in Yellowstone. Now, you know, the one that gets most of the press are these really large, explosive, supervolcanic eruptions. And, of course, if they occurred, they'd be very disruptive and they would, you know, cause global change. But they don't happen very often. You know, we have to start looking at maybe some of the smaller things that happen more on a human time scale. And that's when we're looking at, you know, big earthquakes, kind of these moderate size hydrothermal explosions. The highest hazard and risk to people in the region is probably a big earthquake, magnitude 7 plus earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that's big enough to what causes widespread destruction and happens frequently enough to impact, you know, human timeline. So those are the types of things. And unfortunately, earthquakes do not put out any precursory signals, at least that we know of at this point.
Right. And to Skip's point, by degree, these volcanoes, when they go, I mean, are they generally, a level of eruption, or, you know, are there small eruptions versus large eruptions in the same volcano?
Well, and that's a good point, too, in that, you know, again, people tend to focus on these really large caldera forming eruptions in Yellowstone, but there's been many dozens of smaller eruptions in Yellowstone as well. And these are just like lava flows that have come out since the last volcanic eruptions. The most recent one was 70,000 years ago. But these are lava flows that come out and are mostly contained within the park. So, in fact, if there was going to be a volcanic eruption in Yellowstone, the most likely scenario would be one of these smaller eruptions that, you know, would be disruptive in their own, but wouldn't be, you know, such a huge widespread event as people tend to think of on these big supervolcanic eruptions.
I got to ask you about this one. The maybe I'm saying it wrong, the axial seamount off the Oregon coast, seafloor reportedly ballooning, and maybe that's been going on for a while, but a buildup of magma there, over 1,000 daily quakes. Some say that's suggesting an eruption could occur. What's your take on that? That's probably, you know, interesting to watch, but also a little bit nerve-wracking.
Well, I mean, the axial seamount is another you know, active volcano. It just happens to be under the ocean.
Hotspot.
It's related to a plate boundary. It's seafloor spreading. It's along a rift on the tectonic plate boundary there, and it's just another active volcano. So, you know, it makes sense that it would be active and that it would erupt every once in a while. And there is a history of it erupting in the past. So, again, very interesting and very cool to see that. And hopefully they can get the people who monitor that can get some data related to that. But again, it's nothing really out of the ordinary. Mm-hmm. It is just an active volcano being an active volcano.
Is there anything out of the ordinary going on right now?
Maybe I'm not the right person to ask that because you know, I tend to see these things a lot. I'm in the loop. I talk to people a lot about active volcanoes. But there are certain volcanoes. We just had a seismic swarm underneath Mount Rainier up in the Pacific Northwest. That's something that the Cascades Volcano Observatory pays really close attention to. Mount Rainier is a volcano that hasn't erupted recently, but if it did, it would be a huge impact in the Pacific Northwest because it's covered in ice. Mm. And it would, as that ice melts rapidly, you have these huge, what are called lahars, big floods of mud and debris coming down the mountain tend to cause a lot of destruction. So, every once in a while we have these volcanoes that aren't historically active. They tend to put off a little, you know, for lack of a better term, a burp here and there. Mm-hmm. And that's something that they have to pay attention to see, you know, what does this mean? Does this mean that new magma is coming up into the system or not? So those are the types of kind of, you know, balancing acts that we have to play as far as, you know, is this just, you know, everyday activity or is this something that we need to look into more?
Yeah, yeah. Hidden magma cap discovered at Yellowstone National Park. What's this?
So this is a project that we did back in 2020. We put in about 650 seismometers all throughout Yellowstone, and they ran for about a month all throughout the entire park. And, you know, typically when we're imaging Yellowstone, we have to wait for earthquakes to occur, and then we record the seismic waves from those earthquakes. But we didn't want to wait for all those earthquakes, so we went in, and while these seismometers were in the ground, we brought in what's called a vibrosize truck. And that's a truck that goes in, sits on the ground, and then shakes the ground, and basically creates man-made earthquakes, and we record all the data from those. Mm. And by mapping out the seismic waves from those man-made earthquakes, we were able to map the top of the magma reservoir. And what we found is that the top of the magma reservoir is at about, you know, about 3.8 kilometers beneath the surface of the Earth in Yellowstone. And the top of it is made up of, you know, a mixture of molten magma, what we call volatiles or gases coming off the magma reservoir, and then solid rock. And this is kind of a cap to the magma reservoir where this stuff is pooling up. And this is something that we would expect on an active magma reservoir. But one thing it tells us one good thing about this is that what it tells us is that these gases are actively coming out of the magma. and pooling at the top of the reservoir and then eventually coming off and coming out to the surface. So this means that the magma reservoir is actively degassing, which is a good thing as far as hazard. If the gases were being trapped within the magma reservoir, that could cause more pressure to build up and an explosive eruption.
Cool. That made a lot of people feel better, I think. You know,
I hope so.
Yeah. Tell me, and thank you for that. And I got like a minute left here. USGS.gov. And you guys do something called the Caldera Chronicles. I'm a subscriber. Tell us about your website a little bit and how people, I think it's cool. You got a ton of stuff on there. How do we engage with the work that you guys are doing?
Well, the Caldera Chronicles has been a huge success. And it's a weekly column that gets put out, and it's written by various experts that talk about different aspects of Yellowstone. It's not only on the volcano. Sometimes it's on, the biology and how geology and biology interact in Yellowstone. Sometimes it's about the hydrothermal systems. But it's usually pretty interesting. The public has really kind of globbed onto it, and we put it out to various news organizations, whoever wants to subscribe, and we get a lot of interaction with it. So we hope it's a good education product, and the Park Service has really liked it too, and hopefully it'll be able to keep going.
Well, I look forward to chatting with you down the road too a little bit. I'm looking at your website here too, and this crosses my mind. Oh, I can't get it pull up here. Hot topic, geothermal energy, and how we could possibly harness it. But don't have time now, but can we talk about that later, Jamie?
Sure.
Doctor, any plans for the weekend?
Not really. I just, I'll be up in Yellowstone in a couple weeks to help, start installing some new instrumentation. So getting ready for that.
All right. Super stuff. Thank you for, filling in today or stopping by today, I should say. Really appreciate that and getting us some information. Dr. Jamie Farrell, University of Utah. Have a great weekend, Jamie.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.